On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
You might remember the news story about the heat wave, the mini drought that we had in the summer of 2018, and what it uncovered on Bray Head. There was a giant sign that just spelled out EIRE, ERA, that was uncovered during the drought, and the work is now currently underway restoring it and a few others around, particularly in the East Coast, particularly around Howth as well, trying to restore them back to have them ready for permanent visitation. The idea behind these things was that those who were flying overhead in the middle of the Second World War would know that they weren't flying over any part of the UK, that they were flying over neutral Ireland. And the idea then was to try and spare Ireland from any kind of aerial bombardment. What you might not have known is that that sign at Bray that you might have seen, or indeed the one in Howth, that they're not unique, and that there's over two dozen of these all around the island. Two dozen of these World War II signs, simply just reading ERA, designed to make it clear that it's a neutral territory, believe them. Now, there's a surprising number that still survive amidst the lateral landscape, and in recent times there's been renewed interest in them and in their preservation, all the way from Donegal to Dalkey. And Donal Fallon is here to tell us all about them. Donal, I mean, a lot of people would either have Marie Kondo'd their wardrobe, or they might take to restoring their garden. This is altogether a different kind of a lockdown project, isn't it?
I've been loving this one. I've been following it on Instagram. The good people of Howth are now undertaking the restoration of their sign. And look, if two good things have emerged from lockdown, we can all agree. One, a greater awareness of our immediate environment, because what else have we had to walk around than our immediate environment? And two, a greater sense of community with those who live in that immediate environment, because they're the people that we now see every day, whether we like it or not. And this Howth ERA 6 campaign combines both of those things. You know, what better time did a pandemic to plot the return of an interesting local feature like this one on Howth Head. So a kind of small voluntary local group out there have seized the initiative offered by this, you know, current time to get down to work with the aim of restoring that sign by summer. And for reasons we'll get into, I think that one could be particularly interesting because of who will see it and when.
Yeah, which is probably quite important as well, because I think it was the Bray one that really caught the imagination, because I think it was the first one that re-emerged during that hot spell in the summer of 2018. But you're right, we'll get to it in a minute. These signs are quite distinctive, but importantly, they're right across the island as well.
Yeah, and if you've ever been lucky enough, anyone who's been lucky enough to fly around the Irish coast, you've seen these ERA signs before. And if you haven't, just give it a Google. They're really striking features of the landscape, and they're absolutely massive. I think it's only when you're standing beside one, as I've done out at Dalkey, you get a sense how big they are. They measure 12 by 6 metres. I mean, that's enormous. Marked out in stone and painted with lime wash. So they were a kind of cheap but ingenious way of trying to mark us out clearly from the sky. And they've been known by all kinds of names. Some back then called them neutrality signs. But the story behind them is interesting because I think it gives us a lot of insight into the thinking of the state at that time, you know, around questions of national security as the global crisis was really worsening and the war felt like something that could kind of land on our doorstep at any time.
I'm glad actually that you volunteered that, because I wasn't even sure how to call these for the rest of the slot. So we might stick with neutrality signs or the ERA 6 signs, whichever they are. In some ways, they're not really unlike some of the other earlier coastal markers, like the likes of the Martello Towers, for example.
Yeah, when you're a tiny little island out on your own, but your neighbour, the largest world power in human history, with whom you share a kind of turbulent and changing relationship through history, you really do have to think about your kind of coastal defences, you know, and your vulnerabilities. And that was true whether we were under British rule or not. So the Martello Towers, people might be much more familiar with them. They're not uniquely Irish. They're basically these kind of small defensive coastline forts that were constructed right throughout the empire. But I think we're a lot more familiar with them than most people because of the small scale of our island. They became quite synonymous with Ireland because they felt like they were everywhere. There were 50 of them built on our coastline in the very early 19th century. The fear of kind of French invasion was in mind. And French tried to invade us in the 1790s.
The other world power that's just on our doorstep. We've been particularly blessed that way, haven't we?
Why wouldn't they do it again? But there's just under 30 of those Martello Towers in the greater Dublin area alone, which is absolutely extraordinary. And they've become everything from, you know, beautiful homes to Airbnbs to you can stay in a Martello Tower, an Airbnb, which I think is incredible, to museums. And the most famous one is number 11 in Sandy Cove, right beside the 40 foot. That's the Joyce Museum, very much connected to Ulysses, which opens there. But Martello Towers, when you think about them, they're architectural structures. You know, you can live in them. There's great possibility for reinvention. What we're talking about today, while there were, you know, just as many of them and they were just as kind of omnipresent, they're very different. You know, a Martello Tower could never be overgrown by grass or yeah. obscured by time in the way that these signs eventually were. And there's also the fact that they date from the 1940s, you know, which is the living memory of people around us even still. So I think it's only in very, very recent times that we've kind of set up and said, actually, these era signs on the coast, they're interesting. And they're historically important.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing about them too is that they would have been relatively easy to put together at short notice. If you're worried about a sudden aerial bombardment in the middle of a war that has broken out relatively suddenly, you don't have to try and build a tower. You can just lay out some stones and you've already got the gist of the idea there. Neutrality offered a lot of different and I suppose probably sometimes surprising different quandaries and headaches for the state at the time.
Yeah, and we've looked at it from a few different angles on this lot over the years. And I mean, the joke at the outbreak of the war, and this pops up all the time, but it's actually in MI5's kind of files on Ireland. It was, you know, the Irish question was, who are we neutral against? You know, like, what does neutrality mean? And there are all kinds of questions around things like, you know, navigation lights, coastal watch, censorship. All of that was there from the very beginning. And look, we know now, looking back, you know, historical hindsight's a great thing. Ireland's neutrality on paper was really anything but neutrality. We're very friendly towards the Allies. We gave them everything from weather reports, you know, crucial to the D-Day landings, to the sharing of, you know, intelligence. That would have been unimaginable even a decade earlier. You know, we interned basically anyone who was regarded as a threat to the state or a potential threat to the state. Germans who landed in Ireland were interned. British and American airmen were generally kind of released across the border and just told to keep walking. But, you know, the fact that there were American soldiers in the north, and Churchill said that he hoped that would impress upon the Southern Irish that they are not on the right side of history, and that Belfast was on a wartime industrial mode, you know, building ships and the like, it meant that there was kind of a certain inevitability, I think, in Dublin. They felt there was an inevitability that bombs were eventually going to drop. They were definitely going to drop in Belfast, but the question was, were they also going to drop into the southern jurisdiction?
Yeah, that neutrality question, I think, is probably better framed as the fact that we didn't take up arms, but we certainly had taken a side nonetheless. So then to get to the signs, the neutrality signs or the era six signs or whatever we're going to call them, who actually built them and when?
So the Irish Coastal Watching Service is born in 39, and between 39 and 42, they build 83 lookout posts at kind of strategic points, LOPs they call them, every 5 to 15 miles along the Irish coast. Okay. So they're absolutely everywhere. And each one of them, each LOP, has a unique identifying number. So that's why this sign in Hoth says Era 6.
That's why it's Era 6.
You know,
okay.
And other signs in different parts of the country have Era 81, you know, Era 73 and the like. So each one has a unique identifying number. And, you know, LOP 1 or LOP 1 was in Louth, where there were three positions. 82 was in Inishowenhead in Donegal.
Okay, so you're going clockwise around the 26 county coastline. Okay, gotcha.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of them on the western side of the island, but in Donegal, I mean, Donegal was in a really precarious position in the province of Ulster, you know, two-thirds of which is at war. So you have this, like, remarkable contradiction of Irish neutrality, the Donegal Corridor, a narrow strip of Irish airspace through which British military aircraft were actually allowed past. So the situation in Donegal is particularly kind of vulnerable during the war. But Michael Kennedy, who's a historian of kind of Irish diplomatic history, really interesting stuff. He does a lot of work on Ireland's place in the world, Ireland's diplomatic history. He's written about these in some detail. He says the OPW basically designed them, an identical kind of one-size-fits-all LOP design, if you will, 137 precast blocks, and they'd be brought to the site and assembled.
Okay.
And when you read accounts of them, I mean, remember that the great powers of Europe are at war with each other. You know, the military advancements that are being made. The way he writes about this is brilliant. He says the Defence Force lorries could transport the blocks to the vicinity of the post, local labour with horse and carts. And in some cases, like Erris Head in County Mayo or Carrigan Point in Donegal, donkeys carried single blocks required to slowly move the blocks over difficult ground to the construction area. I just love the idea of the Soviets and the Germans, the British, you know, the French, inventing these new weapons of war and developing war while we were using donkey carts to construct these.
You have the RAF and the Luftwaffe flying over the six counties, and then you've got donkeys bringing stones to Carrigan Point to try and mark out which isn't neutral territory. That's madness.
Extraordinary to picture it. And the men at those positions, I mean, to their credit, we can laugh about the way in which they were constructed, but they were very brave men, and they spent half a decade basically watching the Irish coastline.
They were told also not only how to construct these things, but also how to approach any airplane that might be downed on their territory and what to look out for as well.
Yeah, really detailed instructions. So if an aircraft crashes near your lookout point, your LOP, they're told to, quote, first call a priest or other such clergyman and treat survivors kindly. You know, can you imagine being a downed Luftwaffe pilot in the west coast of Ireland and you see
the
local parish priest approaching and, quote, inform survivors that they're in error. And the senior officer present was instructed to search aircraft to ensure, quote, all maps and documents are to be collected, and also pay books, identity cards, etc. So the Irish state was, you know, very aware of the varying degrees of risk that were posed by the conflict and the need to kind of get whatever intelligence they could from these downed planes. And when you read the Department of Justice files, the special branch files, which are in the National Archives, you get a real sense that they, you know, there was a very deep penetration of the IRA by the special branch. They knew there was some kind of level of dialogue going on with Germany. The Germans had devised a plan for the invasion of Ireland, very oddly named plan. It was called the Kathleen plan.
And there's you're going to have to pause on that one. The Germans had a plan to invade Ireland, and it was called the Kathleen plan.
The Kathleen plan, absolutely extraordinary. I don't think it was taken particularly seriously at the table of the Abwehr, but it was considered, and interestingly, it was discussed with IRA leadership too. The idea of a German, you know, force invading the southern Irish state and charging the border, if you will, absolutely extraordinary. And there's all kinds of odd things going on. Hermann Giertz parachutes into Meath and in a Luftwaffe uniform.
A fine place to visit. Yeah.
Walks to Dublin and actually.
Sorry,
calls
in his
into
uniform.
A guard station.
Sorry, so he's not undercover. He parachutes in and then just walks.
He's in a Luftwaffe uniform. He walks into a Garda station in Wicklow and he asks for directions to Dublin. And it's not the proudest moment in the history of a Garda Síochána. And he spends more than a year and a half at Liberty in Ireland.
Sorry, is it Liberty? Sorry. Because I presumed you said that and he walked into a Garda station in Wicklow, at which point, of course, he was apprehended by the Gardaí and handed over. No. Then he just walked around for a year and a half. That's madness.
And he kind of hides out for about 18 months in the houses of kind of various German sympathisers or kind of IRA figures around Dublin and beyond. So the state is very conscious of all of this.
Yeah.
And they know at the lookout points that, you know, if a plane should come down in your vicinity, there may be items of interest on board that plane. So it is a very serious job. It's worth saying the LOPs, they did their part.
I cannot get my head around the idea, though, of like Nazi Germany, which invented the Enigma machine, which prompted Alan Turing in like the greatest feat of the 20th century engineering to basically invent the computer to undo it. And members of the same army were just parachuting into Meath and then walking to Wicklow because they're getting lost on their way to Dublin. I just cannot conceive of that at all. That's brilliant.
Giertz also brought his World War One medals with him for whatever reason.
Oh, just in case you weren't convinced that he actually was a Nazi combat man. That's on a more serious note, I should probably just dial down the tone a little bit, because obviously despite all these markings, there were some bombs. There's significant bombing in one part of the island, but there was also bombing in the south as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the air signs were kind of as much about preventing those in the sky from mistaking Ireland for her kind of neighbouring island as anything else. We forget just how close Dublin and Liverpool are, for example. But the unfortunate reality is that, you know, the bombs did fall here regardless. And the inevitability that Belfast would be bombed came to fruition. Absolutely horrific. 80 years ago, actually, last week.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Over several nights of bombing, the death toll in Belfast always shocks me. More than 900 people were killed during the bombings of Belfast during the Blitz, in excess of 1,500 injured. And to put that in context, 900 people killed over a few nights of bombing. Around 3,500 lives were lost over the decades of the Troubles. Mm. So, in a city the size of Belfast, everyone would have known someone who was injured or killed in those bombings, which is absolutely shocking. And then you get the horror of bombs falling on Dublin. 31st of May, 41, 28 lives lost in the North Strand. It's kind of like the heart of Dublin's kind of inner city, working class area. A lot of tenements wiped out and the like there. And there were also lives lost in Wexford, Carlow, other places that are more forgotten. So bombs did ultimately fall in the southern Irish state.
And imagine that nobody who witnessed it will ever forget the bombing of Dublin and the events of the North Strand in 41.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to do a lot of kind of oral history with people around housing and tenements and the move to the suburbs in recent years. But people of a certain vintage in Dublin, they always talk about their memory of that night and the bombs falling on the city. When the German planes arrive on the scene, the Irish Army aren't entirely sure what to do. So they fire a kind of series of warning flares. And interestingly, the first ones that went up were in the colours of the Irish flag, in the hope that the Luftwaffe
that they
would realize
figure out what's going on,
where they were. Then there's a series of red flares and anti-aircraft guns kind of open up on them. But it's a really terrifying memory that Dubliners of a certain vintage, they all hold that in their mind. And if those bombings were accidental or not, you know, did the air assigns fail us on that occasion? I don't really think they were accidental. I think when Belfast was bombed, De Valera sent, you know, Dublin Fire Brigade north, which was a very brave thing to do, and obviously broke our neutrality. And I think probably the bombing of Dublin was a warning shot at the Germans, you know, to stay out of what wasn't their business as far as they saw it. Mm. But I definitely think on other occasions, undoubtedly, the air assigns did save lives.
Yeah, well, particularly as you point out, when Liverpool is only about 20 minutes airtime away, the idea that you could very easily mistake one landmass for the other if you weren't taking very, very tight care. These signs, which brings us back to the modern day, sometimes they come to light now in very surprising ways, including something which is unfortunately topical this very weekend, the idea of there being fire on our mountains.
Absolutely. And you know, when the war was over, I find it kind of interesting from a state security point of view that they didn't take them away. You know, they more or less left them all in place. And I presume the view was that eventually, look, that the natural landscape will bury them and they'll be forgotten. Mm.
The Which is pretty much exactly what happened really until a couple of years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, incredible in Bray. There's a serious gorse fire. The Garda air support unit are put up into the sky to kind of, you know, support the fire crews that are tackling the blaze down below. And the guards in the sky noticed this thing in the landscape. And it's thanks to the Garda Air Support Unit that one was uncovered. And then Bray kind of inspires movement elsewhere. Dalkey, the tidy towns in Dalkey, did a really great job on their sign. And, you know, one always inspires the next. And likewise in Donegal and on the West Coast, it's been a great thing for communities to come together and say, how do we fix this? But Howth, given its location, I think will be very different from all the others as a landmark, because the route that it's on means that people who are flying into Dublin Airport will see it. So this thing might become an unlikely rival to the Poolbeg Chimneys, which coincidentally turned 50 this year. And it might rival them for that kind of instantly recognisable sign that you're home.
So that's going to be the new way that if you're looking out now and you're looking for the Poolbeg Chimneys, or if you're looking out for the blue lights on the runways, that you could be seeing the Era 6 sign at Howth, and that could be your way of knowing that you're back home. Fascinating stuff, Donald, as ever. Thank you so much for talking through us. That is really just... I still can't get my head around the idea. I'm going to be haunted now for the rest of the afternoon about the Nazi who parachuted into Meath and just walked to Wicklow trying to find his way to Dublin. Sorry, I'm lost now. I'm just going to have to finish so I can go away and think about that in a cold room somewhere. Donald, as always, thank you so much. Donald Fallon, historian, author of the Come Here to Be Books and the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you get your podcast.
On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.